This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Marijuana laws across the country are changing. Three of the four states that border Indiana have taken steps to relax their laws. Indiana does not allow marijuana for medicinal or recreational use, but in Marion County, our most populous county and home to Indianapolis, the county prosecutor announced he will no longer prosecute small possession cases. Is this the right decision? How do you feel about the nationwide shift in marijuana laws? Let us know on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, and we'll get your questions and comments to our live panel today. Joining me now is Marion County Prosecutor Ryan Mears. Thanks for coming in, Ryan.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
I want to start off with a really basic question. Just to lay the foundation, what we're talking about today, public radio listeners tend to be law-abiding people. What does the Marion County Prosecutor do?
Yeah, so the Marion County Prosecutor, we have the exclusive jurisdiction of enforcing Indiana law here in Marion County as it relates to criminal offenses. So that means that we are ultimately the entity and the agency that's responsible for making a charging decision on everything from a simple traffic ticket up to and including murder cases. And so that results in about 28,000 filings a year. Where we make the determination of whether or not it is appropriate to file criminal charges or not. Ultimately, the thing that we try to do is we want to keep people safe here in Marion County, but we also want to be fair to everybody in Marion County as well. And we're never going to compromise safety at the expense of fairness or vice versa.
So what change did you make when you were the interim prosecutor with cases involving small possession of marijuana?
Yeah, so this is a discussion that we'd had internally in the Marion County Prosecutor's Office for a couple of years in taking a look at our marijuana prosecutions. And so in 2018, when you looked at the number of marijuana cases that ended up getting filed, 74% of those cases would end up being dismissed. In 2019, that number was around 82%. And so as a prosecutor, you know, one of the things that we really looked at was what's the benefit of actually filing these possession of marijuana cases? And why am I as a prosecutor ultimately filing these cases if I think the case is likely going to end up getting dismissed? And so we really just did an analysis of it doesn't make sense to continue to file these cases from a pragmatic standpoint in terms of the amount of resources and time that gets devoted to those cases. But we also took a step back and looked at who was ultimately being charged with these types of crime, who ended up getting arrested. And a lot of times it was people of color. And that was something that really bothered us. If you look at the usage rates of marijuana amongst Caucasians and African Americans, and then you looked at who ended up being charged, there was no question that African Americans were charged at a disproportionate rate. And that was something that really bothered me personally. And so when you took those two factors into consideration, we ultimately decided that there's, number one, not a real benefit to public safety to continue to prosecute these. But number two, we have an obligation to make sure that the system treats everybody fairly. And in this case, we didn't think that it was.
Can you quickly define small possession in this context? How much are we talking about?
Yeah, so it's less than 30 grams of marijuana, which is essentially 1 ounce of marijuana. There's a couple of important caveats to the policy. Number one, if you're out in public smoking marijuana, we're still going to charge people. If you're still dealing in marijuana, we're going to charge people. And if you have marijuana and you're impaired and you know you're involved in a traffic accident or you get pulled over, those types of cases are still going to continue to be filed. What we're talking about is simple possession of marijuana when you just have the marijuana on your person, less than 1 ounce. We're going to decline to prosecute those types of cases.
83% of cases dismissed in Marion County this – I'm sorry, 82% dismissed this year. What goes into dismissing a case?
Yeah, so what would happen is individuals would either most times get arrested, then they'd come down to court for an initial court appearance, and then our deputy prosecutors would have conversations with the defense attorneys, oftentimes public defenders, and try to just get a better feel for what happened on this particular day. And my instruction to our deputy prosecutors was, hey, if it doesn't make sense, if this person is not a violent person, if they don't pose a threat, then those are the types of cases that we need to dismiss and get rid of. And 82% of the time, that's exactly what happened. And so that's why we were very comfortable making the decision to no longer prosecute those cases at all.
What immediate consequences are there usually if you're convicted with small possession?
Yeah, so there's a number of collateral consequences for any type of conviction, especially immigration issues. If for individuals who are in the country, there's significant immigration consequences for a marijuana conviction. There's also significant consequences for individuals who are trying to get student loans. If they're trying to get student housing, a drug conviction can also restrict what types of benefits you can receive federally as you seek out housing. So there are a number of collateral consequences to that. The other thing is a lot of people, when they go to apply for jobs, things of that nature, they do have that conviction on their background. And sometimes employers hold that against individuals. And so all of those collateral consequences, you know, can really impede someone as they try to move forward with their life.
This kind of an offense in Marion County, were it not dismissed, this particular case of small possession, what were the legal consequences? What were they looking at? Just something on their record? Was it a fine? Was it prison time?
Never prison time. So on a B misdemeanor, simple possession of marijuana case, oftentimes it was time served. If the individual got convicted, essentially they would get time served, which means you're just going to have to carry this conviction on your record. There's no further punishment. Small percentage of those individuals were placed on probation for 180 days. And then they, you know, would have to complete the terms of probation, which is meeting with the probation officer, making sure you go to your drug screens, as well as any other counseling or treatment that would be ordered by the court.
Has this change you made had an effect so far?
Well, yes. Number one, we immediately went through and we reviewed all of our pending marijuana cases to see if they fit the criteria. And so we ended up dismissing 240 possession of marijuana cases. So that's 240 individuals who we don't believe need to be in the criminal justice system who are now no longer in the system, which we think is a good thing for Marion County in general. You know, we want to focus our priority on public safety and making sure we're keeping this city as safe as we possibly can. And we're going to devote our resources to violent crime. And by taking those people out of the system, that allows us, the Marion County Prosecutor's Office, to focus on violent crime and not worry about these simple possession of marijuana cases. I think the other impact it has had is hopefully it'll be a benefit to the jail. And hopefully we'll see fewer and fewer individuals have to go down to the Marion County Sheriff's Office and spend the night in jail. It's a tremendous burden on the jail when you have to bring those individuals in, make sure they get processed. Oftentimes they spend a night or two in jail. Sheriff Forstall was one of the first people to actually come out in support of this policy just because he recognized the impact that this had on the jail and the tremendous number of resources that went into individuals whose crime was possessed. Possessing marijuana. I also think it's going to have a tremendous benefit to both the Marion County Prosecutor's Office and the Marion County Public Defender Agency because we no longer have to have prosecutors and public defenders assigned to represent people on these cases, and they can focus on other cases and other issues. We all have finite resources, and we want to focus those resources on violent crime, which we think is ultimately what's going to keep this community safe.
The fact that you won the election for county prosecutor was definitely a surprise for some. You beat Tim Moriarty, who had support from the mayor, Joe Hogsett, and City County Council President Bob Ossoli, among others. Do you think that this policy change was a big factor in that?
I think it certainly elevated the discussion, and I think it demonstrated to people that I'm going to be my own person. And I'm going to make decisions based on what I think is the right thing to do. And, you know, that might have factored into people's decision making when they went in there to vote. But I'm hopeful that what people took away from this is that while I'm at the Marion County Prosecutor's Office, we're going to try to treat everybody as fairly as possible. And we're not going to prosecute crimes that disproportionately impact certain types of people. And that's what we had in this particular case.
What did you do before this?
I was at the prosecutor's office, so I was the chief deputy at the Marion County Prosecutor's Office.
Are there any other policy changes that you're looking into, either related to marijuana or other drugs, or was really this the big one that needed to be changed right now?
No, so we're constantly evaluating what we are doing. And so one of the things that we're looking at right now is possession of paraphernalia, possession of syringes. How do we best handle those situations, and what can we do to help those individuals deal with their addiction issues? You know, if you're willing to stick a needle into your body to do drugs, you probably have some pretty serious addiction issues. Is that something that should be best addressed in the criminal justice system, or is there a better alternative? So one of the things that we're working on right now is we actually started a new diversion program for syringe individuals who have syringes. They get charged with a syringe case. They come in. We tell them, look, you go to this class, you try to get help, we will dismiss your case, no questions asked, in an effort to really try to get people to address whatever the underlying issue or cause of their problem is. I can't tell you how successful the program is going to be because it's new, but that's one of the things that we're evaluating to see what can we do to help people who have legitimate addiction issues.
You've been talking to IMPD leadership or even officers about the change, or rather, have you been talking to them about the change? And can you talk about anything you've heard from the police department?
Yeah, well, I think the first thing is this is not a significant departure. I think a lot of people want to make this into a bigger decision than what it was. Last year in 2018, IMPD, standalone marijuana cases, meaning there was no other charges attached to it, they arrested 200 people for possession of marijuana. There are 950,000 people in Marion County. I would submit to you that there's more than 200 people using marijuana in Marion County. And so the officers were already doing a good job of exercising their discretion of when they should take those individuals into custody. And so I don't think it's a huge departure. We have had conversations with IMPD. Part of this, too, is I'm hopeful that this will lead to safer interactions between law enforcement and the public. You know, so oftentimes we have vehicular chases. We have individuals who are trying to conceal the marijuana that's inside their car, which obviously an officer doesn't know. Are they reaching for a gun? Are they trying to hide a gun? They're not exactly sure what they're, you know, coming across, or, you know, what type of situation they're coming into. And so hopefully with this, people who do have small amounts of marijuana in their car, they'll pull over on the side of the road. And hopefully these interactions will be much more peaceful and not as contentious as maybe is what we've seen in the past, where we see people take off because they're trying to destroy or hide the marijuana out of fear that they're going to get arrested. So we think it can also have a benefit to law enforcement as well.
Well, we really appreciate you coming in to talk about this. Ryan Mears, Marion County Prosecutor. You good to stick around for our next segment?
Yeah, absolutely.
Up next, we'll bring in new voices to talk about the decision from the county prosecutor to no longer criminally charge people for small possession of marijuana. What effect will it really have? And what else might need to happen if officials really want small possession to stop having an impact? As always, we'll take your questions and comments on social media. Do you think we should be less punitive on cases like this? Are you uncomfortable with a county prosecutor making these kinds of changes? Regardless of what you think about this one, let us know on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before we get back to our conversation on small possession cases in Marion County with regard to marijuana, I want to tell you about our last show. We end every week with the Friday Pitch-In, where we catch up on some of the biggest Indiana headlines of the week. You can find that show and all of our shows wherever you get podcasts. Just search for All In Indiana. Today we're talking about new changes to how small possession of marijuana cases are handled in Marion County. We'd love your questions and comments on the topic. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. In the studio, we're still joined again by Ryan Mears. Ryan made the change while he was temporarily filling in for the Marion County prosecutor, and then he was elected into the position soon after. And we're bringing in two new people to the discussion. Mark Nicholson is an attorney in Indianapolis. Thanks for coming, Mark.
Glad to be here.
And Andrew Madernowski. I'm so sorry, Andrew, if I butchered that.
That was spoken just like an old Polish woman in South Bend. That was perfect.
Was it right?
Yes.
Good.
You couldn't spell it, though.
He's a criminal defense attorney in Indianapolis and a member of the Legal Committee for NORML. That's the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Andrew, we'll start with you. What is NORML?
NORML was founded in the early 70s in Washington, D.C. by a group of attorneys and activists who believe that as a matter of personal liberty, the use of cannabis, marijuana, CBD should be legal.
And what's your experience been as a lawyer here working with people on small possession cases like this?
My experience varies from county to county. There are 92 counties in the state. I've practiced in approximately 80 of them, and every county handles marijuana, misdemeanor marijuana cases differently. Some counties, you're doing mandatory jail time. Others, you're likely to get a diversion.
You feel free to name counties if you'd like or not if you're not comfortable with that. But what is the difference? I understand that the differences from county to county in Indiana can be pretty big.
Yes, they can. And I won't name counties, but there are counties where you'll still do another weekend in jail for a misdemeanor marijuana case.
What did you think then when you first heard about the recent change here, that the Marion County prosecutor will no longer press criminal charges for this?
Well, I think it's a good start. I think there are a number of reasons why it should be. My personal belief is that they shouldn't be prosecuting, period, and the police shouldn't be arresting to begin with on these. But until the police are also on board and not making arrests for this, someone is still at the risk of getting arrested, getting processed through the jail, as long as the police continue to make arrests and then the prosecutor declines prosecutions. But I still think it's a good start, and I think it's a matter of, to an extent, triage. The last I looked, we're having a homicide every day and a half or 2 days in Marion County. And frankly, I would rather have those police officers rather than sitting in court waiting half an hour, 45 minutes for a hearing, out on the road patrolling, doing something to prevent crime from happening.
Is that the main reason why you feel that police should be, I don't want to say ignoring this, but I guess ignoring is the best word I can come up with?
I don't think that's the best reason. My best reason that I think it should be legalized completely.
And why is that?
Because I think there are more benefits to the use of marijuana. There's not as much harm as people have been led to believe throughout the years of prohibition. And I think we can certainly prioritize our resources.
Mark, in your work as an attorney, how have you interacted with small possession cases?
I've had a variety of experiences, kind of like Andrew, where you have a situation where someone is given jail time for simple marijuana. Some of my problems start with the fact of the police who like to say that they smell this odor of marijuana, whether it's raw or being smoked, when they pull someone over. Kind of like what Mr. Mears was saying, a lot of the people that the police pull over are members of minority communities, African-American, the black and brown. And so they use that as an excuse to pull people over, to arrest them, to harass them. And that's my issue, because that is something that's hard to prove. You cannot prove whether or not the officer actually smelled what they say they've smelled. And then now this person is caught up in the criminal justice system. And when they're in there, they may get a diversion. If they have any other criminal history, they may not get a diversion. And basically a diversion means that they go through a program, maybe, you know, a drug class, do community service, and then it ends up being dismissed from their record. So my experiences in Marion County have been where most of the clients get diversions, which goes along with what Mr. Mears was saying about the cases end up ultimately getting dismissed. But just the initial part of them getting in the criminal justice system is a problem that I have.
From your perspective, how have small possession cases been treated in Marion County up until now?
In Marion County, the small possession cases, if the person doesn't have the criminal history, have been diversion. And then if they do have a criminal history, if it's simple marijuana possession, that it will normally be resolved, whether it's through community service or some kind of probation, something like that. But very rarely, I can't think of a case where I had where someone just on the marijuana possession alone actually went to jail. I'm sure it's probably happened, but that's not the norm.
Kathy from Facebook writes in, I agree with this step. Marijuana is not dangerous and shouldn't be illegal. Let's move to legalize. This is a question for anyone here. How much of an impact do you think marijuana legalization in other states has had on policies and attitudes around the drug in Indiana?
I think it's been favorable toward my position, which would be legalization. We have Illinois, Michigan, fully legal. Different levels. We've had medical marijuana. Many states have medical marijuana. Ohio, I believe it's always been you had to have up to 100 grams before it rose from the level of what they call a major misdemeanor to a criminal offense. So it's technically not a criminal offense. I should have said minor misdemeanor. And then Kentucky is fairly lax on their enforcement. So we're surrounded by states where people are using a significant amount of marijuana. And I think that's opened up the awareness to people that, look, if an entire state can go legal or medical, such as Michigan and Illinois, that, you know, and the world hasn't gone to hell there, maybe there's something to this, that it could be a source of revenue, a source of medical treatment for people, and not anything that demonstrates a need for significant law enforcement resources to be dedicated towards.
Andrew, do you think that legalization of any kind could happen here in Indiana anytime soon?
I guess it depends on how you define soon.
Well, there has been bipartisan there have been bills introduced by both parties at the state legislature that call for relaxing some of these laws. But they haven't really gone anywhere yet.
No. There are problems with the laws we have in the state of Indiana right now that still don't recognize the fact that you can legally use marijuana in other states and then still come back here, drive a motor vehicle, and be committing a crime because of our drunk driving statutes that criminalize having any amount of a metabolite of marijuana in your body, active or inactive. So if you go on a vacation to Michigan or out to Colorado where you can legally smoke and you're driving a week later in Indiana, that's illegal.
So how has normal then tried to define that or maybe move that and make county prosecutors or other people in the legal and law enforcement profession maybe aware of that? How have they tried to change those things?
Significant lobbying, appearing on talk radio shows like this, testifying at the State House about some of the problems with our statutes in Indiana. Mr. Mears mentioned that this discussion has been going on at the prosecutor's office the last couple of years. Normal's been having this discussion for 30, 35 years. And Steve Dillon, one of the founders of Indiana Normal, as well as one of the first people involved with National Normal, has been talking about this in courts throughout the state forever.
Let's go back to Marion County. Andrew, has Marion County treated these cases more or less severely than other places? And how has it changed over time?
Less severely. Across the board, Marion County has always been less severe. But I think if you talk to prosecutors and judges and police officers outside of Marion County, everything in Marion County is less severe.
Yes.
Is that just because it's an urban area? We have a lot of people,
Urban area. There's different types of crime, a different focus on different sorts of prosecutions and arrests.
Let's talk more about how the police fit into this. Ryan, can you explain how these cases typically go from the start?
Yeah, so anytime a police officer pulls someone over or they initiate a traffic stop and if they find marijuana, it's still up to the police officer's discretion in terms of how they want to proceed. I would say the vast majority of cases, even prior to this policy, if it is a small amount of marijuana, more oftentimes than not, I don't believe the police were necessarily arresting someone. And I think the numbers prove that in the 200 people that I mentioned before. Once they decide to make an arrest or refer that, then it goes to the Marion County Prosecutor's Office where we have to make a decision in terms of whether or not we need to move forward with a criminal prosecution. And so it's at that point in time where we are telling IMPD and the rest of our law enforcement officers, if it's less than 30 grams, we're not going to be filing charges. And, you know, I'm not in a position where I can tell IMPD or any of my other law enforcement partners what to do. But I can tell them very loudly and clearly that if it's less than 30 grams, we're not interested in filing those cases, and we are not going to be filing those cases moving forward.
Issues around police behavior are always complicated, of course, because you can write policies all day, but officers are ultimately going to use their own judgment. Is there something that you think could be done to make things better in respect to the police's role in these cases?
Well, hopefully it's an educational component of just telling them, hey, look, guys, it takes you a really long time to process someone, to book someone on a possession of marijuana case, and then think about the depositions you have to appear at, think of the court hearings you have to go to, all of these things which take you out of service where you could be out there helping people, where you could be out there involved and hopefully trying to solve violent crime. Let's direct our resources towards violent crime. What can we do to solve these murders? What can we do to prevent these murders, as opposed to spending an hour or two on the side of the street waiting for the jail wagon to come and pick somebody up over a very small amount of marijuana. And so I'm hopeful that as these conversations continue, that level of pragmatism will, you know, ultimately win the day in terms of how we're going to deploy our resources.
Mark, same question. Oh, go ahead.
No. I mean, the problem I have with this is that the police are still going to say that they smell this odor of marijuana to stop and pull people over. And that is one of the problems that I see in the African-American community, is that they will pull black people over and brown people over because they say they smell this odor of marijuana, and then use that as a justification to search the vehicle, say the person resisted or acted disorderly or find a gun, whatever it is. And so if the police will no longer say we're going to search someone because we smell this odor of marijuana, that would be a really huge step in the right direction as far as making the police enforcement a little bit better, because now we can't use that as a tool to sit up there and violate people's constitutional rights. And that's one of the things that I believe is still going to happen, even though if they do find that small amount of marijuana, then they may not make that arrest because it is their discretion. But just the initial encounter with the police is by saying, I smelled marijuana.
We did reach out to IMPD to invite someone on the show, and a spokesperson sent us this response, quote, the announcement made last week was the first that IMPD had heard about this shift in policy, and we are continuing to have discussions with our state, local, and federal partners about next steps. Unfortunately, that means it won't be possible for us to make someone available as early as Monday today to discuss this issue. We've talked, Ryan, a little bit about IMPD leadership. What about other city administration? Has the mayor or other leaders given their stance on this?
I'm not sure what the mayor's position is on this policy. The policy is not very complicated. It fit on one sheet of page, one piece of paper when I sent it out to the office in an office-wide memo. It's very simple. If it's less than 30 grams of marijuana and it's not related to someone driving impaired, if it's not related to dealing, and if it's not related to public consumption, we're not going to file the case. And I also would point out that this has been done in jurisdictions across the country. Every major city in the United States has essentially adopted this policy. If you look at Manhattan, Philadelphia, Boston, Washington, D.C., all across the country, even Louisville, Kentucky did this a couple of months ago. This is just good public policy that a number of prosecutors' offices have gone to in order to prioritize resources and address what the real problem is, which is violent crime. And so the fact that we went out here and said this as the Marion County Prosecutor's Office, we did this and we had the opportunity to look at all of these other jurisdictions who made the exact same decision in terms of, hey, we're not going to go to the city county council and ask for more money, but what we are going to do is we're going to prioritize our resources to the most important thing, which is violent crime, to help keep our community safe. And that's what other jurisdictions have done, and that's what we've are doing right here right now.
One day after this change was announced, a statement was released from the police chief in Southport, Indiana, just south of Indianapolis. It says the chief, Tom Vaughn, disagrees with the prosecutor's decision, your decision. And it says, quote, if a law needs to be changed, that should be done in legislation to amend the law. All officers of the court take an oath to uphold and enforce the laws of the state of Indiana. Chief Vaughn will instruct officers of the Southport Police Department to enforce the law as written in Indiana code. End quote. Ryan, how do you respond to this perspective from someone in law enforcement? It seems like it might be confusing for people whose job it is to enforce the law to have the county prosecutor say they're essentially going to ignore that law.
Well, a couple of things on that. Number one, I have a duty and an obligation to make sure that everybody's treated fairly in the system. And I'm coming to you with objective data and objective information to say that not everyone's being treated fairly in the system. And so that's my number one priority, is to make sure that we are making sure that every member of Marion County, every citizen here, is treated the same way and is treated fairly. When we looked at that information, when we looked at that data, we couldn't say that as it related to marijuana cases. It's just a fact. People of color ended up being charged more often. They ended up being arrested more often for possession of marijuana. So my response to that is, yes, we have a duty to uphold the law, but we also have a duty to make sure that everybody's treated fairly under the law, and that wasn't happening, and that's not something I'm going to participate in.
Andrew, what do you make of this perspective that regardless of what you think about this specific change, the county prosecutor, according to the police, perhaps isn't the one who should be making the call?
The police on the street make that call every day. They are free to decide if they pull somebody over, or if they make a controlled buy off of a target and decide that they want to roll that person as an informant up the ladder. They choose to ignore a crime that in every county in the state, dealing cocaine or methamphetamine or heroin, somebody's going to prison for. Not county jail, going to prison. And they make a value determination that this person is more valuable to us as an informant, so we're not going to arrest them, we're not going to charge them in return for their cooperation. So for the police officers to say, no, we have to follow the law as it's written, that's a myth. That's not happening right now. And again, an officer on the street or an undercover narcotics officer makes a prioritization decision, that is very similar to what Mr. Mears is doing, saying we want to prioritize our resources because we're going to get more bang for the buck and more value out of using our resources not to lock up misdemeanor weed smokers, but to go after and prevent violent crimes. If you have five officers, again, sitting in court, they're not out there to prevent that rape, robbery, or murder.
Mark, any follow-up in the last 15 seconds we have?
Yes. Basically, as an African-American attorney and criminal defense attorney, I have heard and been familiar with cases where the police have arrested someone for marijuana possession that was African-American, a person of color, and then not arrested somebody that was white that had the marijuana possession. So.
Lots more to talk about, but unfortunately we have to end today's conversation here. Mark Nicholson, attorney in Indianapolis, thanks for coming in.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Andrew Matanowski, criminal defense attorney in Indianapolis and committee member for the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. Thank you.
Thank you.
And, of course, Ryan Mears, the county prosecutor. We really appreciate you coming in. Good luck on the new job.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
We'll close out today's show with a recent conversation I had with the director of Hesburgh. It's out on DVD and on demand now. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds.
This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. One of Indiana's most famous and influential faith leaders is profiled in a documentary out now on DVD and video on demand. It was in theaters this past spring. Hesburgh covers the life of former Notre Dame president Father Theodore Hesburgh. Among many other accomplishments, he was a prominent player in the civil rights movement and did a lot to bring positive attention to Notre Dame in the latter half of the 20th century. Joining me now is the director of that documentary, Patrick Creedon. Patrick, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
How did the idea come along to make a movie about Father Hesburgh?
I'm a graduate of Notre Dame. I graduated in 1989. And so I kind of knew about Father Ted pretty much my whole life. My father was also a graduate of Notre Dame. And so I knew the name. And then as a student, I obviously knew who Father Ted was. He was his last few years on campus as president were around the time that I was there. My freshman and sophomore year were his last 2 years. And so I knew the name, and I certainly knew the legend about Father Ted. But being a documentary filmmaker, I think at heart, I'm a little skeptical of legends, if you will. I really wanted to see for myself what all the fuss was about Father Ted and how it is that he was, you know, he's in the Guinness Book of World Records. He has 150 honorary degrees. How does that happen? You know, so I started doing a lot of reading and research shortly after he had passed away in 2015. And that was really the beginning of it. And I had also lost my own father in 2015. And it was a great time in my life to reconnect with my alma mater and to be back on campus and telling this particular story. So that was really the beginning of it.
Well, sorry to hear about your dad in 2015, but when you started digging into Father Ted's history and thinking about doing this, did he sort of live up to the legend?
Far beyond the legend. He was a Forrest Gump kind of character in the 20th century. Wherever there were problems in the world, Father Ted seemed to pop up. And, you know, at first I thought to myself, maybe he was just asked to do a lot of this work because he was a Catholic priest and because he was from the Midwest. Maybe for some people, he sort of checked a particular kind of box. You know, if you're doing a commission or some sort of civil rights effort or social justice endeavor, let's call it. That was not the case. Father Ted became a giant in the second half of the 20th century because he was such a spectacularly talented problem solver. And I think that the interesting thing about Father Ted is, I think shortly after people got to know him and got to understand what his motivations were, his identity as a Catholic priest kind of melted away for a lot of people. In some ways, I mean, being a Catholic priest was the part of his life that he was most proud of, and it was his defining characteristic. But truthfully, Father Ted really became a statesman in America and beyond.
It's so funny that you referenced him as sort of a Forrest Gump type, because when I saw it, I kind of felt the same way. I saw him, you know, with Martin Luther King and with presidents and things like that. I thought the exact same thing when I started looking into it. I mean, when he's caught on film in the background of all these historical moments, how was it that he was sort of always in the thick of the action in front of the camera lens?
You know what? I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that he was named president of Notre Dame at the shockingly young age of 35. He was 35 years old, and he became the president of Notre Dame. Within a couple of years there, he was asked by the Vatican to play this major role in the conversations around nuclear usage and nuclear nonproliferation. That was really those talks happened in Austria. It was a global stage. And Father Ted played a critical role there, and here's why. At those talks, which went on for weeks, the American delegation was not allowed to speak with the Russian delegation, and vice versa. They were not allowed to speak to each other. They were not allowed to go to each other's social activities. They were not allowed to be photographed with each other. But here's Father Ted Hesburgh. He's an American, but he's not representing America. He's representing the Vatican. He was able to take this sort of unique position that he played during those talks and build a bridge between the Americans and the Russians. That's actually a big part of our story. He turned a lot of heads during that time in Austria because people kept saying, who's this young priest from America? And how is it that he's doing the one thing that no one else seems to be able to do, which is to bring the Americans and the Russians together to talk about nuclear weapons. It was an extraordinarily important role that he played at those talks. And by the time he returned home to Notre Dame, when those talks were done, he was asked by President Eisenhower to serve on the Civil Rights Commission. I think President Eisenhower saw in him leadership qualities. He saw in him someone who was a straight shooter. Father Ted, from a political standpoint, was an independent. He was not registered to either party. So with Father Ted, he almost acted, I mean, I hate to say a referee. I mean, he was a straight shooter. He never had to face a reelection either. He was not an elected official. That's important because there's a lot of elected officials who can't make tough decisions because they know it might cost them their next election. Father Ted never had that problem. So for a variety of reasons, he just became, we always kind of joke, my team and I joke, he's like, if Forrest Gump met James Bond, and he was a priest, that's kind of what Ted was.
Reality is stranger than fiction, certainly. We've been talking about his big moments. Was there a particular moment or some kind of connection that raised him to the national stage and cemented him as a figure of influence? You mentioned the nuclear nonproliferation talks. Was that it, or was there something else?
I think in America, his legend, if you will, really began to grow around the civil rights struggle. And specifically what happened was in 1957, President Eisenhower kind of threw his hands up. He knew that America was suffering desperately from race relations and racial tensions. And, you know, here's a guy who, you know, he went off to Europe and won World War II and helped defeat Adolf Hitler. This was a man, President Eisenhower, who knew a thing or two about thorny issues and how to solve them. And he became completely exasperated by how to move the needle on race relations in America. So in 1957, he ended up forming a presidential commission. Congress was deadlocked on the issue. So Eisenhower formed a presidential commission. It was six individuals. They were given the power to subpoena. So they could bring anyone they wanted to into the hearings and have public hearings on the issues. So Father Ted and five other individuals spent 2 years mostly traveling through the South and studying the issue and examining what the problem was and how to fix it. Now, here's where Father Ted's genius really, really shined most brightly. At the end of those 2 years, when it came time to write up the recommendations and submit them to the president, the commission itself was deadlocked. There were three Northerners and three Southerners. There were three Democrats, two Republicans, and Father Ted, the independent. And they couldn't decide on anything. They couldn't figure out really even where to begin. And they were cramped up in a naval air base in Shreveport, Louisiana. It was miserable. It was hot. It was humid. Everyone was unhappy. Things were really coming to a grinding halt. Father Ted decided, let's get out of here. He borrowed a plane from one of the university's donors. He flew everyone and their staff up to northern Wisconsin, a place called Land O'Lakes, Wisconsin. And they spent a week there fishing, having dinner together, having a cocktail or two at the end of the night, sitting around the fire at the end of the day. They went to a place that was pleasant and peaceful. Father Ted would put two adversaries in the same boat and send them off fishing for the day. Just the two of them.
Wow.
He had this incredible ability to bring people together, to find common ground, and to build off of that common ground. And I think his work with the Civil Rights Commission and helping get the recommendations drafted and submitted is really where people realize this man is a superstar. If it were not for him, those 12 recommendations probably would never have been written and submitted. And remember, they were submitted in 1959, 4 years later, when the Civil Rights Act of 1964, one of the most historic pieces of legislation ever passed in American history, when that legislation was passed by Lyndon Johnson and that Congress, it was those 12 recommendations that Father Ted and the five commissioners wrote up in Land O'Lakes that was the foundation for what became the Civil Rights Act. And every Civil Rights Act since then, whether it's Americans with Disabilities, whether it's gay rights, whether it's women's rights, Title IX, you name it, every single one of those pieces of legislation stands on the shoulders of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. So when I talk about Thomas Jefferson, or I compare Ted to Alexander Hamilton, George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, I think Father Ted was really kind of a founding father of the 20th century. And when I saw that he had passed away and I saw that his name recognition was fading fast, I thought to myself, it would be a shame if this story faded away. I think we're at an American moment right now where we have a real crisis of leadership in both parties. We have a leadership community, if you will, that doesn't know how to talk with each other. They think that compromise is a dirty word. And I think when you look at Father Ted and the life that he lived, you realize that compromise and teamwork is the only way to make progress in a democracy. And that's why I think his story is so resonant in this moment right now.
There's this iconic image of Father Hesburgh holding hands with Dr. Martin Luther King, singing We Shall Overcome. To be a leader in the civil rights movement then was certainly not a glamorous position. There were threats of violence. Was he ever a target?
There were a lot of those, a lot of Martin Luther King's speeches were violent. In fact, Martin Luther King was supposed to speak in St. Augustine, Florida, about a week before that famous photo was taken of him and Father Ted, and they had to cancel it because it had gotten so violent down there that Martin Luther King realized, this is probably going to lead. This will probably be fatal for people who turn out, and I don't want that. So I'm sure that Father Ted knew the risks of stepping out into the public eye and supporting Martin Luther King and the civil rights struggle. I'm sure he knew that that was dangerous, but I don't think he really gave that a second thought. It's interesting because that photo that you're talking about with Father Ted holding hands with Martin Luther King, their arms are interlocked and they're singing. What's fascinating about that photo is that was a partnership right there. Martin Luther King was fighting the battle for civil rights in the streets. Father Ted was fighting the same battle, but sort of from the 30,000 foot level, let's say, trying to have laws passed, trying to have legislation enacted. You have to have the two of those things. You have to have sort of a ground game and an air game when you're trying to change society. And in that photo, you really see, you see both sides of that struggle coming together. You see both fronts of that war, if you will, standing arm in arm. And I think Father Ted realized that if Martin Luther King and his followers are going to risk their lives and give it their all, then the least I can do is meet them at the same point.
Priesthood, I imagine, is an empowering role when you're trying to impact social change, but in what ways was it limiting to him?
That's a good question. I don't know that Father Ted ever found it to be limiting. I think that he decided when he was 6 years old that he wanted to be a priest. He never looked back. He never regretted it. But you do actually, in the movie, I think you do get a sense of what he gave up and the sacrifice that he gave up. You know, he never got married. He never had children. He never had a family of his own. And when he was asked about that in the film, there's an old interview that he gave to Phil Donahue years ago about being a priest and giving up marriage and a family. He gave this beautiful answer. He said, you know, I realized that the price of belonging to everyone is probably not belonging to anyone. That's what sacrifice is. And Father Ted was handsome, he was funny, he was smart, he was charming. He could have made a fabulous husband and a fabulous father, but he wouldn't have been able to be the man that he was because he would have only been able to give half of himself to either one of those endeavors. As a Catholic priest, he was able to give all of himself to whatever was asked of him. And I think he always imagined that he would be sort of a parish priest, you know, and have a small parish and tend to that community as he could. In the end, his parish turned out to be the world.
Hesburgh, the film about the life and accomplishments of Father Theodore Hesburgh, president of Notre Dame for 35 years, starting in the 50s. Is out now on digital release and can be purchased on DVD or through video on demand. Director Patrick Creedon, thank you so much for coming on All In.
Thank you, Matt.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross and Chris Flood. You can subscribe to the podcast version of this show wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for All In Indiana. Join us next time when we'll be talking about Sick, a new podcast from Side Effects Public Media about the complications of fertility medicine, one Indiana doctor's abuse of power, and the generations of lives he affected. We'll be back tomorrow at this time for that conversation. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In. We'll